Assalamu alaikum. We would like to welcome you on behalf of the Edmonton Muslim Leadership Forum to the Islam and Modern Turkey Forum. This event hopes to explore interfaith dialogue, the modernity challenges, and the philosophy of Sayyid Nursi. We would like to begin with the recitation of the Quran, and I would like to call upon Mahmoud Taraya to come up and recite Surat Al-Hijr. So Mahmoud Taraya, if you can please come up.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تقدموا بين يدي الله ورسوله واتقوا الله إن الله سميع عليم يا صوت النبي ولا تجهروا له بالقول كجهر بعضكم لبعض ولا تجهروا له جهر بعضكم لبعض أن تحبط أعمالكم وأنتم لا تشعرون إن الذين يغضون أصواتهم رسول الله أولئك الذين امتحن الله قلوبهم للتقوى لهم مغفرة وأجر عظيم إن الذين ينادونك من وراء الحجرات أكثرهم لا يعقلون ولو أنهم صبروا حتى تخرج إليهم لكان خيرا لهم والله غفور رحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا إن جاء فتبينوا أن تصيبوا قوما بجهالة فتصبحوا على ما فعلتم نادمين واعلموا كثير من الأمر لعنتم ولكن الله حبب إليكم الإيمان وزينه في قلوبكم وكره إليكم الكفر والفسوق والعصيان أولئك هم الراشدون فضلا من الله ونعمة والله عليم حكيم صدق الله العظيم.
In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful. O you who believe, be not forward in the presence of Allah and His Messenger, and keep your duty to Allah. Surely Allah is hearing and knowing. O you who believe, raise not your voices above the Prophet's voice, nor speak loudly to him. Nor speak loudly to him as you speak loudly one to another, lest your deeds become null while you perceive them. Surely those who lowered their voices before Allah's Messenger are they whose hearts Allah has proved for dutifulness. For them is forgiveness and a great reward. Those who call out to thee from behind the private apartments, most of them have no sense. And if they had patience till thou come out to them, it would be better for them. And Allah is forgiving and merciful. O you who believe, if an unrighteous man brings you no news, look carefully into it, lest you harm a person in ignorance. Then be sorry for what you have done. And know that among you is Allah's Messenger. Were he to obey you in many a matter, you would surely fall into distress. But Allah has endeared the faith to you and has made it seemly in your hearts. And He has made hateful to you disbelief and transgression and disobedience. Such are those who are rightly guided. A grace from Allah and a favor. And Allah is knowing and wise. Sadaq Allah al-Azim.
Thank you, Brother Mahmood, for the beautiful recitation of the Quran and translation. The evening will be moderated by Dr. Abu Rabi, Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Alberta, and will feature Dr. Faris Kaya, who's the leader of the Nur community in Turkey, Dr. Thomas Michael, former head of the Vatican's Office on Christian and Muslim Relations, and Mr. Mirza Akali, ex-minister of Environment for the federal government of Turkey, and Professor Dr. Said Ozervarli. Dr. Abu Rabi is appointed by the University of Alberta as the first holder of the Edmonton Council of Muslim Communities Chair in Islamic Studies, the first teaching and research chair of its kind in Canada. Dr. Abu Rabi was a former professor of Islamic Studies and Christian-Muslim Relations at the Hartford Theological Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. In addition to several important books, he is the editor of the well-known journal, The Muslim World. His research and lecture travels to South Asia, Central Asia, and Turkey have provided him with a productive scholarly network. I would now like to call upon Dr. Abu Rabi to introduce our speakers for tonight's panel.
Thank you, sister. Assalamu alaikum. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'd like to welcome all of you here tonight. And to our Turkish guests who came from Turkey after 19 hours of travel, I'd like to say hoş geldiniz. This is going to be a major event on Islam in Turkey, and I'd like to be brief in summarizing some of the major concepts, since I have published like 4 books on Islam in Turkey. On November 28, 1917, Ottoman Palestine surrendered to the British conquering army under General Allenby, where the mayor of Jerusalem at the time, Ratib Khalidi Pasha, who was an Ottoman Palestinian, surrendered in the name of Ottoman authorities. The question that comes to mind is, what happened to the 60,000 Ottoman troops who were Turks, Arabs, and Kurds? What happened with them when they were captured by the British army? This is a major but tragic chapter in the history of the Ottoman Empire. All of these Ottoman troops from Palestine were led to all the way to Burma, what we call Myanmar, which is to the east of Bangladesh, between Bangladesh and Thailand, and all of them passed away in Myanmar. I happened to visit Myanmar a few years back, and I visited the cemeteries, 2 major cemeteries of the Ottoman army in Burma. In a sense, this tragic episode in the latter part of the Ottoman state summarizes the different tragedies and events that befell the Ottoman army and the Ottoman state, and the radical transformation of the Ottoman Empire from an Ottoman Islamic empire to a secular Turkish nation state founded and led by Kemal Atatürk, who after his own death in 1938 was able to establish a legacy in Turkey that we call Kemalism. And Kemalism is, in a sense, or corresponds to secularism, radical secularism, but it also corresponds to anti-Islam and in many ways anti-Arabism. Badir Zaman Said Nursi, when the Ottoman troops of Palestine surrendered, was captured by Russian troops and exiled to Siberia for 2.5 years. He was able to escape in 1918 and come back to Istanbul. In a sense, the capture of Badir Zaman Nursi and the collapse of the Ottoman state reflected a major crossing point in the life of Nursi as well as in the life of the Ottoman world. Until 1918, Nursi called himself Eski Said, that's to say the old Said. After 1918, he became Yeni Said, the new Said, the new Badir Zaman Said Nursi. So what are the major differences between Eski Said and Yeni Said in the life of Nursi? Nursi was a traditional Muslim alim and scholar in the Sunni tradition. Nursi never invented a sect within Islam. He had been influenced by many Sufi tariqas in the East, because he was born in the eastern part of the Ottoman Empire in 1877. He died in 1960. But nevertheless, he did not define himself as a Sufi, as some people are led to believe in a mistaken way. He defined himself in the context of Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah. But out of that context and the radical transformation of the Ottoman state and the new Turkish state, Badir Zaman Said Nursi was able to reflect in depth on the meaning of Islamic faith in a new secular environment. In 1928, Kemal Atatürk and the ruling regime in Turkey hanged at least 4,000 scholars, Muslim ulama, especially in the eastern part of Anatolia, because they dared to rebel against the Turkish secular nation state of Kemal Atatürk and the total westernization of Turkish people. But Badir Zaman Said Nursi and his movement were credited for preserving Islam and Islamic faith in the high age of secularism and westernization in Turkey. And that's why his own exegesis, what we call in Arabic tafsir al-Quran al-Karim, that had been compiled in what we call Risalat al-Nur. He wrote that in both Turkish as well as in Arabic. And there are 10 volumes of that in the Arabic language nowadays, around 5 in English, and around 2 big volumes in the Turkish language. Risalat-i-Nur, in a sense, had been a commentary not only on the necessity of Islamic faith in a secular environment, but in a commentary on the identity and the problems and the challenges of Muslims in a highly secular but highly aggressive secular environment. And that's why Badi-i-Zaman Sayyid Nursi never gave up on the notion of the Ummah. The Ummah to him before 1918 and after 1918 was the same Islamic Ummah. But he came to understand the Ummah in different ways. In perhaps spiritual ways, in the context of interfaith dialogue, in the context of solidarity between Christianity and Islam that he began to talk more and more about after 1918. And that's why, as somebody said here, his major concept of interfaith is very significant, but it is based squarely on the strength of Islamic faith in a highly and radically changing and aggressive westernized and secular environment in Turkey. Since his death in 1960, of course, Turkey has gone through major transformations. Currently, the ruling party in Turkey has come from an Islamic background. This is a major feature in modern Turkish politics. But of course, the radicals in the Kemalist heritage wanted to obliterate Islam. They wanted to expel Islam from the public scene, if we use a term from our friend David Gowa. That they tried to obliterate Islam, to expel it from the public scene, but they could not do that at all because of the efforts of thousands, if not millions, of committed Muslim women and men in Turkey, those who were committed to what we call the mission and the aims of Risalat-i-Nur, who understood that the days of violent physical jihad are over, but jihad itself is not over. And that's why in the new Sa'id phase, in the Yeni Sa'id phase, Badi-i-Zaman Sayyid Nursi talks about what he calls manavi jihad, normative jihad, that one has to wage jihad by the pen, by the tongue, by interfaith dialogue, by being totally engaged in their environment, social and economic and political environment. And because of this dedication, Sayyid Nursi was able to build one of the largest Islamic organizations in Turkey that had been banned in the past. It's not banned anymore. I came to know about this community over 12 years ago when I met Professor Fariskaya in Istanbul back in 1998 or so. And I was surprised when I began to attend the biannual symposia that Professor Fariskaya was putting on in Istanbul, to find out that in the first day of the conference I attended back in 1999, there were 15,000 people in the opening conference, which is impossible in many Muslim countries. But in Turkey, in secular Turkey, that was highly possible, and that would tell you about the dynamics of religion and state in modern Turkey that we need to know about so much. The activities of the Nur community have not been limited to Turkey. They have gone global in nature. We have lots of people who believe in the mission of Sayyid Nursi, who want to find Islam from his own perspective, and who take Risalat-i-Nur as their guide and master in a sense. And tonight we'll have a chance to listen to three prominent speakers. The first one will be Father Tom Michel. Father Tom Michel is a distinguished scholar of Islam. He is a Catholic priest, an ordained priest in the Jesuit tradition. He lived in Rome. He is a Native American. I had a chance to meet him several times, once in Indonesia over 15 years ago. He is one of the few Western scholars of Islam who is able to give lectures about Islam in three Islamic languages: Arabic, Turkish, and Bahasa Indonesian, Bahasa Melayu. It's amazing. And that's why we are delighted that Father Tom Michel is here. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago under the late Pakistani scholar Fazlur Rahman, who is well known to some of you. So Father Tom Michel will be our first speaker. Our second speaker would be Ms. Zainab Salim. Zainab is a PhD student in Christian Muslim theology at Georgetown University. She is a Turkish woman born in Germany and who grew up in Germany and who was my student in the USA before her husband became our student here at the University of Alberta. So I would like to welcome her and her husband as well. Our third speaker will be Professor Faris Kaya, who is the president of the Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Science. And then we'll have a chance for Minister Riza to speak briefly in Turkish. Zainab is going to translate for him after the three distinguished speakers. Father Tom Michel, please.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. This is my first time. Excuse me. My first time in Western Canada, and it's a pleasure for me. You might be wondering why or how it came about that you heard I'm a Catholic priest. How a Catholic priest might be speaking about Sayyid Nursi. Oh, thank you. Or maybe more surprisingly, why a Catholic priest is reading the Risale-i Nur, which, as you heard from Ibrahim, is the long, it's about 6,000 page commentary on the Quran written by this modern Turkish thinker. The way it happened was this way. I was working in the Vatican. There's an office in the Vatican for relations between Muslims and Christians, and I was working there, and we signed an educational agreement between Rome and Ankara so that every year a teacher from Rome would go to the theology faculty in Ankara and give a course on Christian theology, and a Turkish professor would come to Rome and give a course on some aspect of Islamic studies. This relationship, which we started in 1986, is still going on, so it's probably our most successful, in that sense, academic cooperation. So 1986, I went to Ankara for the first time and began teaching. And through my students, I came to know for the first time the Risale-i Nur. I came to know who Sayyid Nursi was. Many of my students at the theology faculty were they were students of the Risale-i Nur. They were readers. So I began to read the Risale-i Nur starting in 1986. The first thing that I think really impressed me and has stayed with me is Sayyid Nursi's analysis of modern life. For Sayyid Nursi, he's not somebody who wants to turn back the clock and go back to medieval times. He sees that there's a lot of good in the technological progress that we have all made in the world. But he sees a problem with it, and the problem is that of God kind of receding from people's consciousness so that God is farther and farther away from the center of people's lives. God is maybe someone that many people in modern times are thinking about only occasionally. And this opens us up to a lot of dangers. It opens us up to the dangers of destructive and self-destructive behavior. It opens us up to a kind of sense of loss or lost direction, and many problems this way. Now, Sayyid Nursi felt, and he was one of the first people in the 20th century really to talk about this, that really the good Muslims, the Muslims that he's trying to form through the Risale-i-Nur, that when they look around, who are their real allies, you might say, their friends in this modern world where God is receding? And he saw that what he really wanted to look forward to was a unity, he called it, between the good Muslims and the real Christians, the ones who are trying to live like Jesus and follow the teachings of Jesus. And so already in 1911, so that's 99 years ago now, he was calling for this unity. He never used the word dialogue. And I think that it's something for us worth thinking about, because dialogue can be a misleading idea of how we should be relating to one another. Dialogue can mean, and I think in the minds of many people, it means sort of a highly specialized discussion among experts, but not something that really touches the lives of all of us. Or I think in many cases it's even come down to a kind of a worse connotation, that of sort of an interreligious tea party among the leaders, where everybody sits and nobody really speaks very, very honestly or very deeply about anything. We just make nice small talk. What Sayyid Nursi was calling for was something much more important than that. He saw that in the modern world today, what we need is a common witness of faith. By unity, he's not calling for some kind of a merger of the two religions, or he's not calling for any kind of a lowest common denominator on which we can all agree. No, he's expecting that Muslims are going to be very much involved in their religion, very deeply committed to the revelation that they find in the Quran, and that Christians are going to be deeply involved in the following of Jesus that they find in the Gospel, and yet the two of them can cooperate for the values that come from God's message. Now, how does Sayyid Nursi understand the life of a believer in the world today? He sees it. I found one passage that kind of sums it up very, very beautifully. He says that the kind of believer that we need today is one who is responding in three ways to God, who is taking the initiative first. God, who is revealing himself in his word, and our response as a believer is one of faith. But God at the same time is revealing himself, God's own self, as loving and lovable, and our response is worship. And God is also revealing God's self as merciful. And our response to that is repentance, tawbah, and thanksgiving. Now, if this in short is what it means to be an active believer as a Muslim today, it comes very close to, I remember the first question we learned in our Catholic catechism is, why do humans exist? We exist to know, love, and serve God. That's the whole purpose of why we exist, why we are here. I think in this basic element of active faith, we find the basis for the kind of cooperation, the kind of unity that Sayyid Nursi is calling for. We have to bear witness to the to the active, we have to bear witness to the values that we find in the revelation that each of us has received. Now, this Sayyid Nursi knows that this doesn't mean that we're all saying the same thing. No, our two religions are two religions, and they will remain so. But he says we should refrain, at least for the time being, from these kind of discussions that so often have divided us and turned us into enmities. He said that the enemies of Muslims are not this group or that group of Christians. He said we have common enemies, and the real enemies of humankind in the modern era are ignorance, poverty, and disunity. Ignorance, poverty, and disunity. And to fight ignorance, we need education. And real education. To fight poverty, we need development. To fight disunity, we need dialogue. And I think this is where dialogue fits in. It's not this discussion among experts, and it's not a tea party. Basically, the kind of dialogue that I find described in the Risale-i Nur is a shared life. It's when we share life together. And you don't have to have a doctorate in theology to share life with others. All of us are doing it or not doing it. We're either setting up walls around our communities and trying to live as though the others were not there, or we are trying to join with others to pursue our passions for the values of God. The ideas of justice, of peace, of fraternity. And if we cooperate in these things, we're making the strongest argument, the strongest challenge to irreligion or the irrelevance of God that we find so much around us. These are the three points that I really wanted to focus on. As I said, the first one is Sayyid Nursi's analysis of modern life. I think, to me, I really find him as somebody who has... He's not dealing with medieval situations. He's trying to give people today in our modern world a way to be active believers. Secondly, he's talking about the need for this unity between Muslims, and Muslims and Christians. And thirdly, he's talking about the need for having a God-centered consciousness. God at the center of our lives. Our lives make sense if we are responding to God's initiatives. We respond in faith to God's revealing. We respond in worship to God's loving, and we respond with thanksgiving to God's mercy towards us. Now, my final point, and I'll conclude with this. In dialogue, if it's understood as shared life, living together, really sharing our lives together, we learn things about one another that we can't really learn in any other way. Dialogue is a situation of learning. And I want to just conclude with an experience of mine. As I told you, I was teaching in various cities in Turkey, and I have very warm memories of 1 year I went to Konya. Now, for the Christians, you may remember Konya is the ancient Iconium. St. Paul passed that way. In more recent times, Konya is a pilgrimage site for Muslims. It's a place close to the hearts of many Muslims because it's the place where Mevlana, Jalaluddin Rumi, the great mystical poet, one of the greatest mystical poets not only in Islamic history but in world history, lived in this city, and he's buried there. Well, I was going to be teaching in, this happened in 88 actually, in the university there, and I got found a home in kind of a lower middle class part of town, not very far from Mevlana's tomb. And it was a very nice little apartment, but it was empty. Now, the problem was it was really empty. There was not a spoon or nothing in it. The problem was I was only going to be there 6 months, so I thought, oh, I've got a lot to buy just to live here for 6 months. And so I was thinking that's going to get expensive. But the first day I was at the university, and somebody said, "Well, a friend of mine has a bed. If you ask them, they might lend you this bed." So I did. I went to this place and asked the people. I told them who I was, because I heard they had a bed, and they said, "Oh yes, you can have it." So I took the bottom part, the springs of the bed, and I was carrying them on my back to the house that I had just rented. And it was a Saturday morning. People were all out and chatting and going back and forth to the market and standing around gossiping and the like. And they see this foreigner with a bed on his back. And so people were curious, and they said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm going to be teaching at the university. And they said, well, where do you come from? I said, I'm American. And they said, well, oh, you'll be teaching English. I said, no, actually, I'll be teaching in the theology department. And they said, really? Well, then you're Muslim. And I said, no, I'm Christian. And they said, really, you're a Christian. Are you here with your family? And I said, no, I don't have a family. I'm not married. I'm a rahib. I'm a monk. And they said, really? And somebody said, oh, I've never met a monk before. And I said, well, that's what I am. And so somebody else said, well, do you need any help? Is there anything that we can do? And you need anything for your house? I said, I need everything. I don't have anything. All I have is bed. And so somebody said, well, I could bring a chair. And somebody else said they could bring something else. And so I said, well, thank you. So I went and I put the bottom part of the bed in the apartment and went back for the mattress. And by this time, it seemed like everybody on the street knew who I was and everything. And people started bringing stuff. And so for 3 days, they were bringing things, and the whole house was furnished just with things that people showed up with. The second night, there was a knock on the door, and there were two men standing there. And they said, we'd like to see your house. And I said, please, come in. And so they went out in the kitchen, and they started talking to each other. And the one says, well, look, he's got no table here. How's he going to prepare his food? Now, your sister has that table in her garage, and that would fit right in here. And the guy said, yeah, you're right there. And so they opened up, and they look, he's only got three glasses. We'll bring the glasses. And so they were really kind of taking inventory of each of the rooms in the apartment. And the next day they showed up with these big shopping bags full of the stuff that I still didn't have. So I had a second bed, and I had a couple carpets, and somebody brought a hot plate to cook my food on. Somebody else brought a little refrigerator, and then there were a lot of dishes and knives and forks and the like. Well, so I was all set. Well, then it was the first day of class, the next Monday. I went to school and came back about 5 o'clock in the evening. And when I got back, there was a man sitting on the stoop outside of my apartment. And I said hello, somebody I didn't know, and he said, he introduced himself, and he said, you know, my wife came by a couple hours ago, but she couldn't get in because the door was locked. And I said, well, yes, I did lock the door before I went to the university. And he said, oh, you don't have to do that. He says, the women in the neighborhood, they know who comes and who goes. And if there's anybody here that doesn't belong, they'll know it. And I said, all right. I thought, well, this is kind of strange. But then I was trying to think, what could he be driving at? And I thought, well, by locking my door, I was telling everybody in the neighborhood I didn't trust them. So I never locked my door again. I was never locked it for the next 6 months. And it was really nice. Sometimes I would come home from the university, and I'd find sitting there a covered dish. And I'd open it, and there'd be some rice in there and some eggplant and maybe a bit of lamb. And it was usually enough for 2 or 3 days, and I'd eat it and wash the bowl and set it, and it'd disappear. And then after a couple more days, then something else would show up. I'd get some other kind of food. Sometimes I would come home, and all my shirts would be ironed and washed and hanging on hangers. And sometimes I'd come home, and everything would be cleaned up. All the newspapers would be put away, and the house would all be swept. And I never saw who did this. It obviously was some women in the neighborhood, but who they were, I didn't know. Well, this went on for 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, the semester was over. It was time for me to go back to Rome. And there was one of the men that came by to say goodbye. And I said, I have a final request. And he said, what's that? I said, well, for the last 6 months, some women of the neighborhood, or one or more, I don't know, have been coming in, and they leave me food, and they wash my clothes, and they clean the house, and they've really been good. They've really been treating me well. And I'd like to meet them just once, if I could, and thank them. And his answer, I'll never forget. He said, you don't have to thank them. They didn't do this for you. And I thought, He said, they did this for God. And God, who sees what they do in secret, God will give them their reward. He said, our religion teaches us that hospitality is a very important thing. And also we find in the Quran that we're supposed to give special good treatment to rahibler, to monks like me. He says, in treating you well, these women were only worshiping God. Do you see what I mean? This is the kind of thing that you can learn about somebody's religion only through dialogue. You don't find this kind of lesson in books. I had a doctorate in Islamic thought. But through dialogue, I do learn a different kind of thing. And I think this is what Sayyid Nursi is driving at. We are called to really live the best of our religion in love for one another. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Father Tom Michel, for this wonderful talk. This is important in light of the fact that, especially since 9/11, Muslim cultures and peoples have been highly distorted by the Western mass media. And that's why we need more and more Western people, so to speak, to live in Islamic cultures in order to discover the sense of divine generosity in the Muslim world, which is commanded by the Holy Quran, as Father Tom Michel has rightly said. I'd like to call upon now Ms. Zainab Salim to deliver her talk. Not in German, Zainab, in English.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon all of you. I'd like to thank the Muslim community of Edmonton for hosting this wonderful event, for organizing the program. And I would like to thank particularly Professor Ibrahim Aburabi, my beloved mentor, and who was, along with Professor David Goa, organized this event. Well, it really presents a challenge to me to talk about a very extraordinary intellectual who fundamentally shaped my own thought, my faith in a very crucial way, in a very essential way. Please allow me to share a little piece about my own personal background. As Professor Aburabi mentioned, I was born and raised in Germany. So I have multiple background. My parents, traditional Muslims who immigrated to Germany in the 1970s, like the large majority of the 4 million Muslims in Germany who came largely from rural, underdeveloped areas from Turkey. And I'm very proud of that. I'm proud to be a child of a worker's family. My parents never had the privilege to go to school. So with all the young people, the immigrant children, the third generation, I experienced a lot of challenges throughout my life. We grew up in Germany with these kind of multiple backgrounds. We lived in a very secular, kind of aggressive secular environment. And as I said, this had a lot of challenges coming along with that. So living a traditional Islam at home and then going into the society, into the German society, which had a very different experience with religion and history, a very painful experience. As you know, when the sacred meets the secular, there are lots of issues, conflicts arising. And as a visible Muslim, we had a lot of conflicts. So I was introduced to Said Nursi's work, Bediüzzaman Said Nursi's work, 9 years ago. And as I said, the third generation growing up in schools and facing these kind of questions all the time, having throughout the education being faced these challenges, questions from non-Muslims, why are you practicing, why are you believing in these kinds, why are you fasting? And it didn't help the young Muslims to just live a traditional Islam. There had to be a way to really internalize belief, to address these questions in a way, to give answers which really satisfies not only the mind, but also the heart and the intellect in large. So giving answers which really help young Muslims to face these challenges, to address these questions. So Nursi, as an Anglican theologian and priest, Dr. Ian Markham, put it very nicely, he said, Nursi's situation has so many similarities with the situation that confronts every person of faith in the West. Nursi faced an aggressive secularism, as do Western Christians and also do Muslims in the West. Nursi wanted to affirm the achievements of science and democracy, as do we. Nursi felt it important to challenge unbelief, as do we. And Nursi is a mirror that continues to reflect the challenges of the world in which we all live. So I think that really talks to us. I mean, if a Christian theologian has discovered Bediüzzaman in such a way where he sees himself in his writings, that really tells us something. And most of the numerous movements of the past 150 years, as the Iranian scholar Mohammad Shabistari observed, characterized almost without exception as Islamic movements have had little, if anything, to do with the resurgence of religious faith as such. So all the political, all the Islamic movements which are known until now focus mainly on the external world, transformation of society, transformation of the of the respective societies. So there have been very few scholars who really addressed the faith-based addressed the faith in a very fundamental way. So those movements often focused on a transformation of their respective societies, while overlooking that true transformation and reform of society is only possible with a sound and faithfully strong individual. So you can, of course, only transform a society if you have an ethically, morally, faithfully strong individual. And this is what is today highly needed. We need scholars, we need intellectuals like Nursi, who really address the internal world of the believer, who addresses why is prayer so fundamental, why is fasting so fundamental and essential, why is belief in God so essential for the harmony, for the global peace and harmony of the world. So in that regard, it is worth to mention that the recently published book of Tariq Ramadan, with the title Radical Reform, Islamic Ethics and Liberation, calls Muslims to participate in a transformation of society and not simply remain in an adaptation mode. So as you know, Tariq Ramadan is always addressing young Muslims in Europe to be part of that society, to come out of that adaptation mode, not only to protect themselves, but really be a part of that society and try to form and shape it. Now, Nursi would definitely agree with that, but he went one step before and said, yes, we need to be part of that society. We need to be as Muslims trying to shape the society, but we can only do that if we have, as I said, faithfully, ethically, morally strong individuals. And I think the Muslim world and Muslims in the West face the crisis today, young Muslims especially. There are very few people who address to internalize belief, to really offer a kind of way which helps young Muslims to be strong enough to go out in a society and to be active part of that society. So, as I said, this is, Tariq Ramadan has definitely a point. This is just the argument that he said. We have to come out of that adaptation mode. And as you know, here are many young Muslims, being also children from immigrants. You are in the Canadian society, but you need to have a strong, faithful belief to be part of that society. Because Nursi is always coming with a Tawhidi paradigm. What does Tawhid mean? Unity, right? Monotheism. So this fundamental idea that he's trying to bring across in his works, in his Risale-i Nur, is to implement monotheism, this unity, this Tawhidi idea, in all spheres of life, in the internal realm, in the esoteric dimension of Muslim faith, the mind, the intellect, and the soul, but also the external world, so the exoteric, the outer world. So we cannot have a Tawhidi idea, a monotheistic idea, if we exclude the internal or the external. So there must be a balance. And that's what Nursi, as far as I can see, is trying to accomplish in his work. He is trying to implement a Tawhidi paradigm, that we as Muslims, as young Muslims first, implement monotheism, unity, this oneness in us, and then this oneness in a positive form into the society. And this is all what we see in the creation, and this is what Bediüzzaman Said Nursi always tried to deliver in his writings, to see everywhere the sign of monotheism, to see the signature of Tawhid everywhere, in an unbeliever, in a non-Muslim, it didn't matter. I mean, so that's his fundamental message. So Said Nursi is one of the few extraordinary individuals who dedicated his whole life to the renewal of faith, that very transformation of the self, the microcosm. So he's always talking about the microcosm because he follows the fundamental idea of, if you know yourself, man arafa nafsahu, faqad arafa rabbahu. So if you know yourself truly, then you will also know God, you will know your fellow believers, you will know your fellow human beings, But people who don't know themselves in a very true meaning in their microcosm, they will not be able to really have an idea about society, about the outer world. They will be disconnected from the larger humanity. So Nursi advocates a unity of both spheres of life. He attempts to establish the Tawhidi paradigm in the fullest way, and he puts emphasis on matters of faith and thus the individual, but without excluding or dismissing to transform the rest of society. Many Islamic reform movements or Muslim reformers dismissed either the one or the other dimension of human existence. Some of them gave too much weight to political issues without paying attention to the believer's condition, and a true transformation can only happen with a strong, faithful, ethical, and moral individual. Therefore, it is not surprising that Nursi pays great attention to the individual while always reminding us that the outer world cannot and should not be dismissed. So at the center of Nursi's concerns was the nurturing, maintenance, and development of individual belief. For these to obtain and for the relationship between human beings and God to be strengthened, public order and social harmony are not only useful and desirable, they are absolutely essential. And I think that's the whole idea, how he and his followers were trying to maintain the social order. So there is this idea of non-violence, trying to change the society in a way, in a very peaceful way. So he never resisted with violence. He never made any kind of, you know, military revolution or whatever. He could have. He founded this large movement, but he was always following the social order. I mean, he maintained the social order, and he promoted nonviolence. So, for it is unbelief, according to Nursi, which disturbs public order and spoils it more than anything else. Nursi believed that he was trying to safeguard people from the threat of anarchy and encourage the establishment of social harmony through his work. The Risale-i-Nur, which focuses first and foremost on the reform of the individual by emphasizing the constant need to renew one's belief in God. As an adjunct to the central theme of individual belief, Nursi posits 5 important principles which one must take on board if he, she is to avoid social, political disharmony and unrest. So the 5 principles are necessary, even essential at this strange time, in order to save the social life of this nation from anarchy. He says, the 5 elements are respect, compassion, refraining from what is prohibited, security, and the giving up of lawlessness and being obedient to authority. So Nursi's primary focus then is on the faith of the individual, the peace and the security of the collective, which grows out of this and cannot be imposed on society from above. So he's trying to have a revolution of the minds, of the intellects, of the heart. So Nursi was not a utopian but realistic, and knew that a total Sharia-based Islamic state would be an illusion in the current time and age. So he's trying from the ground to reach the individual. Again, his goal is to establish an awareness of God in the internal world of human beings. To his mind, the time has come for collective personalities. Now, that's a very, very important concept in Nursi's ideas. The collective personality, the shahsul ma'naviyya, that each one of you has a puzzle, has a piece, important piece, because every one of us, each of us, is created as a very unique individual created by God. And all of us, with every specific ability and capacity, coming together creates this collective personality. And he says that it's a time not for trying to change things by yourself, but to be united, what Father Tom said before, to come together as a collective personality and bring all our abilities and strengths and our positive character traits, bring them together and create that collective personality. According to Nursi, the modern age is the mass age or age of the community or social group. Communities give rise to collective personalities or spirits. In the case of government or authority, in this complex modern age, they can only function adequately by means of collective personalities of the sort. This was the reason why he was so opposed to a sole authority within a one-party system. His call to his followers to work strongly with Christians and other believers is exactly due to this concept of collective spirits. It is in that light that one has to understand Nursi's visit of the Greek Orthodox Patriarch in Istanbul, which took place in the spring and summer of 1953. Without true union, he says, even with people of different religious backgrounds, the evils of the world cannot be eliminated. Unfortunately, neither Muslim nor Western scholarship has paid much attention to Nursi's intellectual thought. Dr. Imtiaz Yusuf enumerates several reasons for that dilemma. He says, first of all, it's the non-availability of information about Said Nursi in many local languages, but right now we have, thanks to the Istanbul Foundation for Science and Culture, a lot of translation, but still there is a huge lack in Muslim scholarship, Western scholarship, when it comes to Nursi's thought. The second is that there is a largely political orientation of contemporary Islamic thought. So Islamic studies tends to focus more on political movements. And third, the consuming attraction of emerging political events of international ramifications, which divert attention from serious study of profound Muslim thinkers, such as that of Said Nursi. Now, in the context of the Muslim world, the dominant preference for the traditional form Islamic education based on rote learning approach has led to the shunning of new investigation and critical inquiry. Hence, the unfamiliarity with the contribution of Said Nursi to the tradition of Islamic intellectual discourse. So, as I said, Said Nursi is a rare diamond of Islam, waiting to be discovered by the Muslims and other members of humanity, hence all the more need to study and reflect on Risale-i-Nur. It constitutes a color of ink in the ocean of the meanings of the Quran. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Zainab, for this talk. I just want to corroborate what Zainab had said in terms of modern Islamic thought. We hear so much about some distinguished personalities such as Jamaluddin Lavani, who died in 1898, or Sheikh Muhammad Abdu, who died in 1905 in Egypt, or Rashid Rida from Lebanon, who died in 1917 or so, or Allama Iqbal of India, who died in 1938. But we never hear about Said Nursi at the time, although he was a contemporary of all of them. This is mainly because the Western studies about Turkey after 1916, World War I, focused primarily on secularization and the building of the nation state. In a sense, those studies dismissed religion entirely. That was not the case in the 19th century. And here we have Professor Said Ozer Varley, who is a specialist on the intellectual history of the Ottoman world in the 19th century. But we have to include Said Nursi as a major figure along Allama Iqbal, or Muhammad Abdu, or Sheikh Rashid Rida, or Avani, or Sheikh Hamka, who is also of Lebanese descent, but who was born in Aceh, which is part of Indonesia in the 19th century, and he was a major exegete, mufassir of the Holy Quran. Sheikh Hamka is well known. He was a Shiite. When he went to Indonesia, he became a Sunni and commented on the Holy Quran. I would like to call upon now Professor Fariz Kaya. Before he comes to the podium here, I'd like to say that Ustaz Badia Zaman Said Nursi, in his major Risalat al-Nur, speaks about, of course, in terms of Islamic theology, about what he calls Ahlul Dunya, the people of this life, and Ahlul Akhirah, the people of the afterlife. And Badia Zaman Said Nursi was imprisoned for 29 years of his life by the Kemalist regime in Turkey. But he never gave up on Islamic faith. On the contrary, the people of this life, Ahli Dunya, were extremely upset with him because he would not listen to them. Because he said, my life is part of the afterlife. And I have known Professor Kaya for the past 13 years or so. And he's a member of Ahlul Akhirah, in a sense. He's totally devoted to Islam and Islamic Dawah in a global age, in the age of globalization. Professor Faris Kaya.
Good evening. Assalamu alaikum. So, I would like to begin with, in order to make my talk short, a story. It is said that two shepherds met each other in countryside. One of them asked the other one, what would you like to eat in the countryside? The shepherd replied, I would like to eat onion, the central part of onion, with bread. And then he asked him, what would you like to eat? He said, nothing left behind. So nothing left behind for me to talk, actually. After Father Tom and maybe Ibrahim Abu Rawi and Zainab, but since he announced my name, I would like to just, you know, say a few words. Who is Said Nursi and what is the essence of his works? And before that, thank you very much, Professor Ibrahim and Professor David, who made our visit able to Canada. And then I thank a lot to the Islamic Center of Edmonton, Islamic Society of Edmonton, that made this evening possible for us to come together. Now, Said Nursi, he was born in 1876 and lived a very dynamic life, witnessed the collapse of 600 years old Ottoman state, the transition period, and the emergence of modern Turkey, secular Turkey. Historically speaking, the collapse of Ottoman state was not a minor change on the world map, but something more than that, a major intellectual, cultural, and scientific revolution that resulted in sweeping away sacred and religious facts from all spheres of life. Nursi had his preliminary training at the local schools of the time. He had an extraordinary learning ability called photographic memory. He never forgot anything he learned. He memorized over 80 basic books of Islamic sciences. He later said, these books became a ladder for me to reach the sky of Quran. I use these books how previous Muslim scholars understood Quran. So I followed their pattern. Due to his extraordinary intellectual capacity, he was welcomed by the Eastern governor of the time, Tahir Pasha, to stay in his palace in Van, in 1819 something. So when we are talking about late part of 19th century, think that the wheel is not rolling yet. There is no way, there is no aircraft, there is no, maybe little bit, you know, train services, etc. No telephone, no internet, no television, nothing. And he read some journals coming from the West and learned from Tahir Pasha, because Tahir Pasha used to speak 7 languages: French, Latin, German, English, etc. Arabic, of course, Turkish. After knowing the paradigm of the scientific and technological development of Western Europe and comparing it with that of the Ottoman state, he conceived in his mind an educational project. For him, the religious and physical sciences should be taught together. That time, in Ottoman educational system, only religious sciences were taught, because they said that they have already left behind to learn physical sciences. Then he called to establish a university called Medrasetu Zehra. When he explained his project to Tahir Pasha, Tahir Pasha wrote a letter to the Sultan of that time, Sultan Abdulhamid II. And Said Nursi went to Istanbul in 1907 with the encouragement of Tahir Pasha to present his educational projects to Sultan Abdulhamid II. Unfortunately, he was not allowed to meet with the Sultan because of his youth, and he was sent to mental hospital for being engaged in unnecessary business comparing with his age. After his disappointment in Istanbul, some years later, in 1911, he visited Damascus, the cultural and intellectual capital of the Ottoman Empire of that time, and delivered a Friday sermon which came to be known as Damascus Sermon, as Father Tom touched a few minutes ago, in which he analyzed the major problems of the Muslim world and offered remedies. The First World War. When World War I broke out, he was taken prisoner of war by Russians and exiled to Siberia in northern Russia for 2.5 years till 1917 revolution. He escaped and returned to Turkey. When he arrived in Istanbul, unfortunately, that time Istanbul was under the occupation of Western Allied forces. He stayed in Ankara and he struggled against British forces in Istanbul. And that time Mustafa Kemal and his friends were establishing the foundation stones of new state. Mustafa Kemal invited him several times to go to Ankara late 1922. He went to Ankara, but attending to certain gatherings of the first parliament, he saw that it is difficult to cope with Mustafa Kemal, and then he left Ankara. He went to Van. Then his next exile started. In 1926, Said Nursi was exiled to Western Anatolia. And he was forced to settle in Barla. Barla in Greek language, coming from barleis. Barleis means loneliness. So he was imposed to stay in Barla, and his settlement with Barla, Nursi's settlement with Barla, the emergence of Risale-i Nur started. During these extremely difficult living conditions, he wrote by hand a 6,000-page commentary on Holy Quran. Millions of copies were reproduced by hand and distributed from village to village by special postmen called the Nur Postal Services. until 1952. So imagine, from 1926 until 1952, all Risale-i Nur were reproduced by hand. And in 1952, they started doing by machine. What is Said Nursi's mission? Nursi heartedly felt the emerging materialistic winds and tried to keep the Ottoman people intellectually equipped to stop 300 years old of materialistic, spiritless, and mechanistic vision of life. When the emergence of modern Turkish Republic, Nursi no longer had a national base to continue his struggle and became a world citizen in creating religious awareness and uplifting the sacred. Hence, his struggle is not based on national, geographical, material, and political basis, but purely on spiritual grounds. His first and last lifelong battle was with his own soul to improve his heart's feeling. The 6,000 pages of Quranic commentary is the result of his experiences of self-struggle. But he says, it is a fact that millions have saved their faith with Nursi's exemplary life and his magnum opus Risale-i Nur. It is beyond religious prejudice to say that the Risale-i Nur is instrumental for the followers of all traditions to improve and preserve their lives. Risale-i Nur is a kind of faith-based Quranic response to globalization, a commentary challenge to the scientific materialism of globalized world. The life, text, and movement. The movement and Risale-i Nur are mixed with Nursi's life in a way that it is not possible to separate them. Here I will point out some facts in order to shed more light on the movement in order to understand the mission that Said Nursi worked on for more than 8 years of his life. The essence of his work is about proving the existence of God, the angels, the truth of revelation, prophethood, and life after death. His explanations are based on the names and attributes of God. This is very important. For him, this world is a guest house, and men and women have a very short life. In this short life, they have to gain everlasting hereafter. Everything in this world is a proof of eternal life. Hence, the universe is a book to be read to know God. Universality and comprehensiveness. His views are not written in the traditional systematic way of Quranic interpretation and traditional Islamic books. The verses are carefully chosen from various parts of Quran related to essential topics of faith and potential solutions for the major problems of our time. Nursi was much concerned that generations of the modern age were not going to have sufficient time to study religion, because today most of our life is passing in traffic and answering cellular phones and internet and watching TV. So we don't have time to actually look after our spiritual life. In this respect, the Risale is not a book of religious teaching, but a method of understanding life, the universe, the reason for creation, and total human responsibility towards oneself, towards God, and towards fellow beings, and towards environment at large. Nursi didn't intend to teach anyone but his own soul. Coming from his strong sense of humility, Nursi's writings provide experience and thoughts on spiritual training. If you read his books, he announces his soul. He says, "Oh my blind soul, oh my sinful soul." He's not addressing anyone else but his soul. He states, "The Risale-i Nur is an account of my life. I didn't write anything that I didn't experience in my life. I found in the Risale remedies for my internal wounds. Those who are looking for spiritual remedies can benefit from Risale Nur. Another important aspect of Risale Nur is positive action. This is very important. What is positive action? Nursi did not base his works and efforts on differences which would lead to clashes. The center of his work is based on commonalities, positive action, and common goals, all of which lead to unity. So that's why when we are reading and talking about Said Nursi, no matter which denominations, which religions we are belong to, leads us to unity. Because he never mentions differences. He says, put aside differences. Let us, we have oceans-like common things. In another dimension of positive action, he urges his students not to criticize others, but to put more emphasis on their own views. He also said that everything created contains truth. Even if they seem to be evil, one may find points of benefit in them. He left behind no worldly affairs, no property, no family. Even his grave was violated and his body was removed to an unknown destination. Today, for example, we do not know where his grave is. Nursi was sent to exile and from time to time jailed, all in an attempt to stop him from spreading Quranic truth. I have a few more pages. Nursi and his ideas were open to pluralistic views. For him, the truth is truth, no matter where it comes from. And others also may have truth, he says. He thinks that even a false group or community may have truth, and of course, vice versa. Among his contemporaries, Nursi was the first to see the importance of interfaith cooperation. I don't call it dialogue, because dialogue is a kind of ceasefire. But cooperation, more what Father Tom said, unity. He did not name his efforts dialogue, but cooperation. And he called faithful Christians to join forces to work together. He visited the Art Patriarch in Istanbul in the early 1950s and sent a letter along with one of his writings to the Vatican, addressed to the Pope of that time in 1952. Isn't it, Father? Oh, yeah, something. The heart of his message, stressed both in his visit and letter, was essentially to have the faithful followers of Islam and Christianity work together to save humanity from the damages of materialistic atheism, which Nursi anticipated was going to destroy the innate nature of humankind. Dynamic mission. Risale-i Nur and the community founded around it are unique for a number of reasons. One of the most important points is that the community is text-based and no individual leadership is involved. My name is announced the head of Nur Movement. This is not true. I consider it that it is written by mistake. Because Nursi says that I have no followers. Risale-i Nur is my teaching system. If you read Risale-i Nur, you are in touch with me and you are in touch with Quran, with the revelation. Teamwork is greatly appreciated. He encourages teamworking in spiritual matters. His books are effective in changing bad ethical behaviors so that one becomes like an angel. The team operates with strong consultation and are guided by the spiritual facts in the Risale-i Nur. The second important point is that no worldly aim is involved. For example, in Nur movement, there is no leadership, there is no membership. Okay? So there is no election. There is no society. 100% volunteer work is being carried on. Another important point about the enmity which today humanity is suffering. In his words, the enemy was neither other nations of the world nor the followers of different religions, but ignorance, poverty, and dispute. The remedies are education, development, and cooperation. As a sign of transformation, one of his Nursi students in prison once came to him and asked if from a religious point perspective, it was permitted to kill a mosquito or similar insects. This person had been jailed for killing several people. Another important point is being refrained from politics. Nursi had neither a political aim nor agenda. He expressed his view on politics saying, "I run away from politics as I run away from Satan." A'udhu billahi minash shaitani wa siyasat. For him, today's politics are based on lying. This perspective became one of the most distinct features of his writings that distinguishes the Nur movement from other Islamic political groups and lobbies. For him, politics is a method that destroys the sincerity, hence life after death. And lastly, he strongly believed and called on faithful followers of different traditions, regardless their nationalities, countries, and religious background, who are in need of such a vision to work together in order to survive at this time of inhumane materialistic invasion under the tension of aggressive secularism. Thank you very much for listening.
No, not necessarily. If you want.
Yes. Thank you so much, Dr. Faris Gaya, for this. You know, we have a respected minister here with us from Turkey, who is a follower of the Nur community, but hopefully he will have a chance to talk tomorrow at the Running Center, since we'll have a conference that starts at 2, to which all of you are invited. But perhaps we will take a few questions for a few minutes, since it is 9 p.m. now. And you can address your question to Professors Tom Michel, Farazkaya, and Zainab. Yes. The question is, what are the major differences between the Hassan Banna movement called Al-Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood movement that Sheikh Hassan Banna founded in Egypt in 1928, and between the Risalat al-Nur community? So what are the major differences? Perhaps Dr. Faris could ask.
You can respond that.
Well, I have written on that. I don't want to respond to that.
It's okay, brother. Yeah, you do it. It is your field.
Well, just briefly, because, you know, I am not a guest, but they are. Briefly, Hassan Banna, Sheikh Hassan Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood movement, which has become the most important Islamic political movement in the Arab world and outside of the Arab world, because in Indonesia we have also a significant branch of the Ikhwan. This movement, its major aim had been to get rid of British colonialism in Egypt at the time, and to establish an Islamic state that would lead finally, in the final analysis, to the re-establishment of the Islamic Caliphate, because the Hassan Banna movement, the Ikhwan al-Muslimin, in many ways was established in response to the collapse of the Ottoman Empire officially in 1923. And this is very similar in many ways to Jamaat al-Islami of India that was established by Allama Maudood in British Lahore in 1941, because Allama Maudood also had intended to get rid of British colonialism, establish an Islamic state that would be a stepping stone towards an Islamic caliphate. Now, as we heard from our respected speakers, Nursi was in a different stage in his life. He did not believe in military jihad. He believed in spiritual and normative jihad. His intention after 1917, after 1918, in the Yeni Said phase, was not to establish an Islamic state, but to preserve Islamic faith in the context of high and radical secular regime, which was the Turkish Kemalist regime. So these are the major differences, and some major people have written about that. In some of the books I published, I have published a number of articles on the relationship between the Ikhwan al-Muslimin of Egypt and the Arab world on the one hand, and the Nursi movement in Turkey on the other hand. What is significant, I believe, is that the Ikhwan is well known in literature. We have lots of ideas and lots of books written about the Ikhwan. The major book was written back in the 1970s by the American professor of the University of Michigan, Richard Mitchell, which is called The Society of the Muslim Brothers, which is a classic in the study of the Muslim Brotherhood movement, whereas the Nur movement was not that well known until only the past 10 years or so, as a result of the symposia and conferences held in Istanbul every 2 years or 3 years. Yes.
Communicate with each other, and how are the school based? Who takes care of the structure if there is no hierarchy?
Yeah. Well, it is very peculiar, you know. It is one of its kind. I would say like this: voluntarily they come together. In every, say, small street and district, they have meetings and gatherings in the evenings. And, for example, today is Sunday. Maybe in Istanbul, of course now is daytime, but at this time of the day, you could find about 400 or 500 different places. People come together and they read Risale, they read Quran, they do a sort of spiritual maintenance about their spirit. Father Tom also, you know, he attends some certain, you know, meetings. And this is a usual practice, not only in Istanbul, everywhere, until tiny corner of a village, you know, in a corner of Anatolia, and in abroad also. So those who are affiliated to Nur movement, they simply come together with no registration, with no membership, with no, you know, sort of leadership. Maybe one of them who can read better, give explanation on Risale, he leads the, you know, reading, that's all.
You know, what Professor Farskaya is talking about is what we call in Turkish Dershani. Dershani is similar to Dersani in Arabic, which is a Quranic study center. And this has been the major aim of the Nur community, is to set up and build different Dershanis around the world. And they have done that in Indonesia and Malaysia. And I hope that they will do that in Edmonton too, for the sake of the Muslim community.
Last Tuesday, I was in a city in eastern Turkey, Erzurum. And Tuesday evening, about 8 o'clock in the evening, there were about 1,000 people crowded into a room that just kind of filled that many. The room was full. And they read the Risale-i Nur for, I guess, about an hour, and then they broke for tea, and then we had a, since I was the guest there, then I said something, and then people asked some questions and gave comments and that sort of thing. But I've been many times, and it follows pretty much the same pattern. reading of the Risale-i Nur, and then there's usually a hoja who can make some explanation about it and have some tea, and then people go home.
Just from my own experience, I mean, to give you a feeling how, you know, the Nur movement in Germany is increasingly growing. So many young Muslims get attracted to the works of Nursi. And it's really interesting how it starts to be an indigenous movement. I mean, there's no hierarchy. Like we as young Muslims, German Muslims, come together. Not relying on authorities from Istanbul or any center. People, young Muslims, get inspired by that work, but they still transform it in a way which applies to the local circumstances, to the German society. So we cannot come and say, okay, even though Turkey experienced an aggressive secular system and still experiences, to take that example and totally implement into in the German society. So there's still, of course, always this flexibility. And the interesting thing is the young Muslims, they come together, and through that internalizing of faith, they get motivated and encouraged to be a part of that society and to really contribute to the greater good of that society. And there's no, as I said, hierarchy. Or I think that's the attraction of that work, that Nursi is not trying to say here's an authority and you have to follow it. I think which speaks very much to the idea of individualism. That it maintains that individual idea that every believer has this flexibility and very flexible to have different ways to participate in the society. And Risale-i Nur coming together is not reading Nursi's works. I mean, it's actually following the examples of the companions of the Prophet who came together to understand what does the Quran mean for us in our daily lives in our particular specific context. And this is exactly what we are doing. We are coming together. Let's see how this ayah, how this verse can be applied to our own specific context. And it's not coming together reading a work by Nursi. It is his work, definitely, but it's always inspired by the Quran. And when you open the book, when you open the Risale-i Nur, you will find that he starts always, that every sentence is either referring to an hadith, to a Quranic verse. And this is how it works. And this is how the companions actually approach the Quran. Not just memorizing, rote memorization, but really to understand how we can apply it to our challenges today. And so I think that speaks to us. And that's why it's really attractive in Europe today.
We'll take two more questions, please. Yes. Fatiha, please. Yes. Is there a microphone?
Is there any plans to introduce the Risale-i Nursi in the educational system to change this stereotype about Muslims? It's all jihad and terrorism and all of this. This is represent the spirit of Islam and the harmony, and would be very, very beneficial if it's introduced not in university, in the schools, that because they are the future. Is there any plan for that?
Well, the question, what you are saying is not something easy, you know, to do that. But we are hoping that if the individual changes, you know, it is easy to change the world. But if the individuals unchanged, or if you don't change the individuals, how are we going to change the world? Because change begins from the individuals. If the teachers are positive, because one day in prison, a few students go to Said Nursi and then asks, our teachers are not talking about God, you know, they are directing our attention to materialism and naturalism. Nursi says, don't listen to your teachers, but read physics, chemistry and biology. Chemistry and biology will teach you the right thing. So in this respect, actually, biology, chemistry, maths, or whatever, you know, sciences are correct. But only wrongly motivated teachers are redirecting them, you know, in different way. So if the individuals are okay, or if the individuals are able to read the book of universe, then the problem will be solved. And how to make this process faster, I think tonight this is an example of it. So if this goes on and on and on, and it will, of course. And secondly, you will find, you know, perhaps Father Tom is going to touch that schools and things, you know. Please.
I just want to relate to you what somebody was telling me in Erzurum this week. There's a university there, and he was saying that up until about 20 years ago, this university was it was very much a Kamalist tradition, non-religious, very often atheistic, and he said that through the Risale-i-Nur, the reading of the Risale-i-Nur, it's become now where the rector of the university is a student of the Risale-i-Nur, and we had a meeting on Wednesday evening with the university professors, and 40 of them were there. What I'm saying is the whole emphasis of Sayyid Nursi is always on personal transformation. And when the person is transformed so that he or she becomes a Muslim for whom God is really at the center of their life and at the center of their consciousness, then the things around them, their society around them, will be transformed. That's Sayyid Nursi's idea. And I think that in this way that sounds rather disorganized, sounds like, well, how did this come about? He said just more and more people have started to study it, and thus the university itself is transformed.
And the strength is the weakness of the ties, you know. Because if you have strong ties, hierarchy, membership, etc., then if it breaks down, it finishes. But if the individual, the strength comes from the individuals, it never breaks down. So the strength actually lies within the weakness of the organization. There is no organizational, you know, structure within a Nur movement.
Sheikh Zak, please, you have a question.
Thanks a lot for a very good informative presentation. Now, I gather from all the speeches that we have heard that this movement is gaining momentum and strength, not just in Turkey, but worldwide. How would that compare with other movements, religious movements in Turkey, such as the Gulen movement or anything else that you care to mention? And how is this religious movements are accepted today in secular Turkey? Thank you.
If I may comment on this, I was going to talk about it only briefly. As our speakers have said, the Nur community and Risale-i Nur has affected millions of people, especially in Turkey and Turks in Germany and Turks in Australia and so on and so forth. And there have been two prominent names who have been very much influenced by Risale-i Nur. One of them is called Harun Yahya, who has written hundreds of books in different languages. He is a follower of Badia Zaman Said Nursi. And one of them is Fethullah Gulen, who is referred to as Hoca Efendi in Turkish, who has been living in exile in the States since 1999, for the past 11 years or so, who still studies Risale-i Nur every morning after Fajr prayers. And I had a chance to meet him and talk with him about that. So he's very much influenced by Risale-i Nur. He's one of the major leaders of the Nur movement in present-day Turkey. And he himself was imprisoned by the Kemalist regime in the 1970s because of his religious ideas. So that's a good question too, but, you know.
Yeah. Now, when we are talking, as Ibrahim points out, about Risale-i Nur, Risale-i Nur is sort of an umbrella resource for those who are really willing in Turkey to understand what Quran stands for. Okay, but of course there are a lot of different, you know, tiny groups or reading circles that they take it in different way. Not only Harun Yahya and Fethullah Gulen, there are several other, you know, tiny, you know, groups. They are tied up with very loose connections, and but their source of understanding Quran is Risale-i Nur, all of them. And of course there are some other Islamic, you know, groups also in Turkey, like Nakşibendiye, Kadiriye, etc. Sufi, pardon me, Süleymancız, yeah. Sufi groups mostly, you know, and like tariqa, you know. But text-based and most important and widely established, say, is Risale-i Nur study circuits.
If you're looking for numbers, an estimate that I've heard that seems to be pretty as good as any would be 9 million people. But don't think of it only as a phenomenon in Turkey and among expatriate Turks. I've been in the Philippines and in Indonesia, where there are very active groups that are studying the Risale-i Nur, having seminars, meeting every week, doing the sort of things that that Zainab and Faris have been saying.
Just to add on Dr. Faris and Father Tom's point, Bediüzzaman Said Nursi actually addresses that question, that there is a diversity of religious groups, of Islamic groups, and he says that that diversity has to be accepted as a richness, because every group specifically focuses on a certain aspect of that religion. I mean, if you have the Sufi orders, they are basically emphasizing a certain aspect. Then you have the Süleymanj, then you have different other groups in Europe. So he never really goes into condemning or excluding them, because as we said earlier, he's not interested in focusing on differences. He said all of them have to be accepted because everyone is doing a certain kind of the same job, of the same business. And another person is maybe more attracted to spirituality. I mean, I'm not saying that Risale-i Nur is not offering that spirituality, but there are certain types of different people. It's a question of taste, a question of certain desire, and that's perfectly fine. That we all have different kind of interests and abilities, and so that brings us to different groups. So he specifically addresses that question in his work, and he's not excluding or dismissing either of these groups.
Okay, last question, please.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to thank to all organizers and speakers for this extraordinary event. And second of all, I am very happy to hear from Mr. Thomas. He's been in Erzurum, which I'm from. And I hope you like the people and hospitality over there. And my question is, Bediüzzaman Said Nursi's, one of his aim was to gather the Muslims and Christians together to fight against the atheism. Is this point satisfied now, or we're a little bit ahead? And is there any step from the Christian groups, especially from the Rome? Thank you.
Yes.
The question was, has anything been done in this way, in the line of bringing Christians and Muslims together? And what is the response of Christians? In Turkey, there are a number of Christians. I wouldn't say very many. Well, there aren't very many Christians to start with in Turkey, since the population exchange between Turkey and Greece. So there aren't very many Christians. But some, one of the most prominent Christians in Turkey, Monsignor Marovic, who was the Secretary General of the Episcopal Conference of Turkey, was very close to has been very close to the Nur movement for many, many years. In Rome, People don't know very much about the Noor movement yet in Rome. You have to remember that the translations from Turkish have not really been around very long. In the translations into English are still not complete. We don't have the whole of the Risale Noor in English. We have maybe about two-thirds, I guess, to three-quarters translated. Well, in Italian, for example, you still have very little that is available. And in most European languages, maybe German would be an exception, but most other European languages, not so much has been translated as yet. And so we're at a much earlier stage. When we have seminars and things in Europe, it's basically trying to introduce people for the first time into who Sayyid Nursi was and what he was trying to say, sort of what we're doing here.
One last point, because we're out of time. Please, Fadda.
Okay. Father Tom, you were saying that maybe Second Vatican Council was maybe on the invitation of Sayyid Nursi, probably. Because, I mean, when we are thinking of 1965, 63, 64, first. And secondly, now if you look at this wave of dialogue or the... Muslims and Christians coming together under the name of dialogue. So it is also a response to Sayyid Nursi's, you know, call. And thirdly, this sort of, you know, this sort of social events doesn't take place in a second, you know, like earthquake. In his time, you know, and there are a lot of actually obstacles in front of, you know, Muslims and Christians come together. Number one, for example, 9/11, etc. You can say several, you know, other things. And what, I mean, we can say, for example, you know, this political, you know, invasion of Afghanistan, Iraq, etc. The Saddam Hussein's, you know, things. And then think of, you know, this. There are a lot of actually obstacles. And Israel's, you know, intervention, because a single political mistake destroys, you know, several hours of, maybe several years of spiritual activity. Because people's mind, you know, is very much linked with, you know, mass media, news, TVs, etc. So a single, you know, political unwanted action actually destroys all spiritual positive steps. This is also, you know, an important fact that we have to consider.
Thank you. Father Tom Michel and the gentleman there mentioned Erzurum. Erzurum is a major city in the eastern part of Turkey, very close to Iran. Erzurum is the Turkish name of the Arabic Ardurum. That's to say the land of the Romans, the land of the Christians. Because that was the name given by Arab historians to that part of the world. And Ardurum was conquered by the Arabs during the second caliph, Umar ibn Khattab, radiallahu anh, in the year 636, early on in early Islam. So Arabs have the right to reclaim Ardurum from the Turks. With this, we come to a close of this session. We'd like to thank our speakers, Professor Tom Michel, Professor Faris Goa, and our future Professor Zainab Salim as well. Thank you very much. We'll turn this over to our MC, please.
Thank you, Dr. Abu Rabi. So I guess Dr. Abu Rabi actually thanked the speakers on my behalf. And so I would just like to call Mr. Maqsood Paracha to provide the closing remarks for the evening.
We have benefited tonight from a very stimulating and informative dialogue, as I'm sure you will agree with me. So I would not take any more of your time except to offer a vote of thanks on behalf of the Edmonton Muslim Leadership Forum and the Edmonton Council of Muslim Communities. I'd like, first of all, to thank our distinguished scholars and speakers for giving us the benefit of their time. and sharing their thoughts and opening our minds, in fact, to something that has not been very well known. In fact, I just was sharing one little fact with Professor Kaya during dinner, that I happened to be in the UK a couple of months ago and just happened to lay my hands on a book which is written by a Muslim residing in the UK. His name is Mojloom Khan. And this book is entitled 100 Most Influential Muslims in History. And I was really interested to see that the name of Badiuzzaman Sayyid Nursi was amongst these 100 most influential Muslims. And tonight, I think it really has opened at least my eyes as to why he chose this name among those 100 illustrious Muslims, starting with the time of our beloved Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and also with the Khulafa Rashideen and other intellectuals and leaders such as Ibn Khaldun, Imam Ghazali, and so on and so forth. So obviously, I think this Nursi movement really has a lot of substance behind it. So without any further ado, I would like to thank again our distinguished scholars and speakers for coming and sharing their thoughts with us. I would also like to thank you for coming this evening and sparing us your time. Please keep in mind that this Edmonton Muslim Leadership Forum is still in its formative stages. This is one of the first two programs, actually, they put together. And with your help and support, inshallah, they would be providing many more other stimulating programs in the months to come on diverse topics that Dr. Muin Yahya mentioned earlier on. So we would like to count on your support on an ongoing basis for this newly formed Edmonton Muslim Leadership Forum. With that, I'd like to thank also the organizing committee of the EMLF board, which has put together this program, and also for the catering facilities for the academy here. And I'm sure that we'll all agree they did a wonderful job in providing us a delicious meal. So thank you again for everybody, and assalamu alaikum. Good night.